Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guests today are Patricia Summers and Matt Valentine, the editors of Campus Carry, Confronting a Loaded Issue in Higher Education from Harvard Education Press. Pat Summers is an associate professor in the Program of Higher Education Leadership in the Educational Leadership and Policy Department at the University of Texas at Austin. Matt Valentine teaches writing at the University of Texas at Austin, where he is a fellow of the Trice Professorship in the Plan 2 Honors Program. Their book, Campus Carry, brings together a range of voices and perspectives to examine one of the most pressing issues confronting American institutions of higher education today. Pat Summers and Matt Valentine, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Pat, you've been studying the issue of firearms on campus, and for people who may not be aware, can you tell us exactly what the term campus carry refers to?
Yes, and let me add that both Matt and I speak for ourselves and not for our institutions. Campus carry is a movement that started a number of years ago to allow the concealed carry of weapons on campus, specifically handguns. There are now a number of states, and I think Matt can probably fill us in on the number, that have campus carry in some form or another. Texas. Ironically, the bill passed and went into effect on the 50th anniversary of the Texas Tower shooting, which was the first mass shooting on a college campus in the United States. Campus carry does allow people to conceal carry handguns on campuses with, in some cases, restrictions on permitting and training and so forth. Matt, do you want to add some more details to the laws?
Sure. So at the time we wrote this book, and it was published in November of 2020, so just a few months ago, the number of states with these campus carry policies was 10. And it's actually a little bit hard to pin that down, because the number of states that implement it in different ways sort of splits it into a few different categories. Since then, it's only been a few months since publication, but it's already out of date in the sense that there are a couple of additional states that have enacted campus carry legislation. Montana is one of those, and that policy was just stayed by a judge this week. So, it's a very dynamic situation with in terms of, you know, how far and wide this policy is spreading, but it is spreading at a fairly accelerated pace.
Matt, you're a journalist, and you've been covering gun related issues for a number of publications. Can you give us a little sense of how this idea of campus carry got started?
Well, you know, a lot of people have the impression that this was a, sort of a response to the Virginia Tech shooting, but and certainly, you know, concerns about campus safety, at, you know, following the Virginia Tech massacre, are part of it, and have informed people's thinking about gun violence and ways that campuses can respond to it. But campus carry actually predates Virginia Tech by 3 years. And it began actually as a footnote. The Attorney General of Utah was ruling on another matter concerning Second Amendment rights and included just in, as a footnote in his advisory opinion that the University of Utah's ban on guns on campus was unconstitutional. That was then challenged by the university, and there was a legal battle, which they ultimately lost. And so Utah became the first state with what we typically think of as, you know, sort of a contemporary campus carry policy. So, you know, it wasn't a response initially to any, you know, immediate situation with campus safety. You know, a lot of the subsequent policies point to Utah and say, well, look, it worked there. So it, you know, it has been relatively harmless there. So it's not a big deal if we expand this to other states. That's what proponents of the bill would argue. But, you know, there are lots of consequences of campus carry policy that are sometimes ignored. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of those as we progress in this.
Yeah, I want to talk about a number of those. But I think it's important that according to your research, this was not a grassroots movement of students demanding the right to carry firearms into classrooms because of what happened at Virginia Tech.
No, no. There is a student organization that has national reach called Students for Concealed Carry. It was originally called Students for Concealed Carry on Campus, and its name has changed a little bit. But it is often sort of framed as the grassroots movement of student activists who want to be able to carry guns on campus in order to protect themselves in the event of an attack or personal safety, you know, fears about stalkers and things like that, fears about sexual assault. But, you know, that really is more of an AstroTurf movement than a truly grassroots movement. They have the Students for Concealed Carry have some funding and organizational support and infrastructural support from the Legislative Institute. They have ties to a number of well-established sort of right-wing activist organizations. And in fact, at the University of Texas, when our campus carry law was implemented and took effect in 2016, the New York Times came down to report on it, and they were only able to find one student at our campus of 40,000 undergraduates who identified himself as a member of Students for Concealed Carry. So it's
certainly not a broad-based grassroots movement by any stretch of the imagination.
Ironically, historically, higher education has been a kind of a raucous enterprise from the beginning, back in the medieval universities in Europe, mm-hmm. where students brought their swords to campus and they had mostly sword fights over honor issues. And that carried over into colonial colleges as well. There were shootings at Harvard, Princeton, a very famous one at the University of Virginia in the 1840s, where the dean of the law school was murdered.
Yeah, your story there was hair-raising.
Yes, very much so. And the five students who were involved in that had to flee campus, including one of Jefferson's nephews. And it's interesting that over time that changed, and most colleges and universities banned guns and other weapons on campus. And so eventually college campuses and K-12 institutions became some of the safest places to be free from gun violence. But that did change because of a couple of court decisions. The Heller case and the McDonald case, which essentially said that government could not dictate individual gun ownership, particularly in private homes and apartments. And as a result of those two cases, then the courts found that states controlled the gun laws, and as is currently the case, the states were more conservative over time, and so that's why we have now a patchwork array of different campus carry and what's called open or permitless carry in all 50 of the states.
Could you repeat that just real quick? Because there's some distinctions there that I'm not sure our listeners are going to be aware of.
Certainly. Campus carry is when, in most states, when you can concealed carry with some kind of permit or training. There is also a movement, and in fact, we just passed a law in Texas for what's called permitless or constitutional carry. Again, it is concealed carry, but essentially there are no requirements. Anyone can have a gun with no training and no permit. And Matt, I think you have a little bit more information on this law, which just went to the governor's desk for signature last week.
I have been following it some, and I'm prepared to discuss that if that's where we want to go with the conversation now. Tom, does that?
Sure. Oh, yeah. That's fine. Okay.
So, you know, Texas has gotten a lot of attention for its legislative session this year, the 2021 legislative session, which, you know, our governor has described as the most conservative session in a century. Of course, you know, words like conservative, you know, sort of get turned inside out and upside down when we're talking about gun laws, because we're talking in generally the Republican Party supports more permissive gun laws, which, you know, in an abstract sense would be considered liberal. Yes. But of course, it's not liberal politics in the American context. Sort of one of the headline grabbing features of our current legislative session, or just ended legislative session, was this passage of constitutional carry, as the proponents like to call it, which, you know, frames the idea as being that you know, as intended by the Constitution, there should be no regulations on firearms whatsoever.
No restrictions at all.
No restrictions. And then, so this is framed as a restoration of gun rights. And campus carry was sort of an incremental step toward that. I mean, and really, you know, it can feel to some educators like a sort of a bait and switch, because when campus carry was promoted and discussed, you know, there were a lot of assurances being issued by lawmakers and by proponents of this policy that said, well, only people who have a permit are going to be carrying, and only about 1% of the population of Texas gets this permit. So we anticipate that, you know, the number of students or faculty or staff carrying guns on campus at any given time may only be, you know, a few hundred in a university of tens of thousands. And that this population of people who have the permit are law-abiding citizens. And they would point to the Texas Department of Public Safety records that show, you know, relatively few convictions for people with carry permits.
The responsible gun owner.
Right. So that was a big part of the sales pitch for campus carry, was that these precautions were in place. of course, those of us who were sort of following the movement and paying attention to sort of, you know, what was happening in other states and also what, you know, advocates of campus carry were also advocating for, were aware that the end game, the goal was so-called constitutional carry, which is just no regulations at all. And that's where we are. Of course, that's being presented now as a sort of a harmless policy as well. You know, when our legislators proposed this bill here in Texas, they said, well, it's the law of the land in 20 other states, which, you know, Pat and I were just discussing a couple of days ago, to say, could that actually be right? Well, sort of, you know, there are different levels of restrictions in other states, but most of these are brand new. I mean, a lot of these states, you know, Idaho passed its constitutional carry law in 2020, Iowa in 2021, Kentucky expanded theirs in 21. You know, it's
and probably all of those were experiencing pandemic shutdowns at the time, so we don't really know exactly what the consequences are going to be like because we've all been away.
Right. And so you have to look at the few cases of states that have had this kind of law on the books for a little longer period of time. You look at Kansas, which passed constitutional carry in 2015. And, you know, you look at the gun deaths as recorded by the CDC. And what you see is that in the year that they passed it, gun deaths were about the same as they had been the previous year. They went up slightly the following year. But then by the third year into implementation, they were up by about 30%. And that's held since. So now is that, I mean, of course, it's not as simple as saying that's cause and effect, but
sure.
You know, the idea that this is a policy without consequence is not supported by the evidence.
Yeah, I want to talk some more about some of those consequences. At one point in your essay, you suggest that campus carry functions as a kind of wedge issue, which sometimes state legislatures may use to further defund higher education. I was wondering if you could speak a little to this issue and perhaps the role of the American Legislative Exchange Council in this movement to arm our campuses. Pat, can we start with you?
Yes. Certainly, campus carry has come at a high cost to colleges and universities, not just the social psychological impact, which we can talk about later, but there are things that come with the various campus carry laws, including signage, including gun lockers to store guns while students are on campus. So it's been very expensive in terms of the expenditures that colleges and universities had to outlay. Plus, there are many kinds of trainings and safety precautions and working out policies between students, faculty, staff, administration, and campus police. And I'll point out that by and large, campus police departments and police departments in general do oppose campus carry and open carry because the more guns there are, the more violence there is. And it makes their jobs much more difficult if there are a variety of laws about carrying guns.
Yeah, I think that's probably a point that a lot of people don't often recognize is how really worried the presence of guns on campus makes our police officers.
Exactly. And I've talked with campus police officers, and they are very concerned. They realize the risks. They realize how on edge faculty, students, staff, administrators are about the possibility that if someone disagrees with you over an issue, that they'll pull out a gun and start shooting you. So there is a very high level of fear.
Yeah. But even beyond that, and I think this was in your essay, maybe I'm mistaken, but maybe we can speak to it just the same, that by proposing campus carry for a state and then sort of getting an understandable reaction from campus communities, that is, you know, I've spoken to my students about this issue, and it's the very rare student who thinks that it would be a good idea to have people armed inside of a classroom. You know, that as a response to this kind of legislation, campuses sort of get up in arms, and then legislatures point to liberal college professors indoctrinating their students, and that serves as sort of a further impetus to cut funding to higher education because of that whole discourse that we see proceeding about, you know, I mean, there's a clear partisan divide in this country about funding for higher education, where we get, Republicans who believe that higher education is a bad thing for the country, and Democrats who tend to think that it's a good thing for the country. And I think I got this from your book, that was sort of precipitated by some of this legislation.
There is an anecdote in the book that we share about Anthony Bouchard, who is a state legislator in Wyoming, who's again in the news because he is a he's running a primary campaign against Liz Cheney there now. But a few years ago, he was threatening funding for some humanities education programs in at the University of Wyoming because he saw a student presentation about gun violence and race and considered it to be liberal indoctrination, had a confrontation with the students and with their instructor, made the pitch basically for campus carry, which he's been a proponent of. He's introduced campus carry legislation there in Wyoming at least twice. It precipitates a pretty predictable response from the academic community. People are offended by it. They march, they demonstrate, and then that is sort of politically useful for politicians who want to frame the university community as being in opposition to conservative values. There are plenty of examples of that, but the Wyoming case is one that comes to mind.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. And both of you, of course, are veterans of the fight against this at the University of Texas at Austin. Can you speak a little bit to, it sounds like quite a colorful protest that happened there?
Yes, a whole series of colorful protests. When the law first went into effect, a number of students got together and formed Cox Not Glocks, because in Texas it was illegal to display a dildo in public, but it was not illegal to conceal carry a handgun on campus. And so there was a very large demonstration covered by what seemed like hundreds of journalists from all over the world, called Cox Not Glocks, where there were a number of dildos, hundreds actually of dildos, that were brandished. And there were no arrests for open carry of dildos. And I think they made a very good point. However, as a result of that very colorful protest, a number of the student leaders were singled out. One or two of them had videos made about them by various people, where they ended up being victims of violence or shot in the head because they were trying to fight off an armed intruder with a dildo. And in fact, one of them actually ended up leaving town because of that. She was sleeping on friends' sofas, couch surfing from going from one city to another, trying to stay ahead of the people who were threatening her.
It's unbelievable. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the other consequences of the proliferation of firearms on college campuses. This is the New Books Network. Welcome back. My guests today are Pat Summers and Matt Valentine of the University of Texas at Austin, who are here to discuss their recent book, Campus Carry, Confronting a Loaded Issue in Higher Education. I'm trying to figure out where to go from here. There's so much to talk about. Whenever a shooting or a gun-related incident on a college campus is discussed in the news, I always hear from my wife before I go off to work the next day that I should just give all of my students A's. So maybe we should start there with the impact of campus carry on the work lives of our faculty.
Well, Pat has done many interviews, hundreds of, I think, of interviews with faculty as part of her research. So I'll defer to her to sort of begin that discussion.
Yes, we've done over 200 interviews with faculty and staff at the University of Texas at Austin about how campus carry has affected their interactions in the classroom, outside of the classroom, their interactions with fellow faculty members, with students. And there is a great deal of concern, a great deal of anxiety. It's clear that campus, the idea of campus carry and not knowing who is carrying a gun, who is angry on a particular day, does chill speech in the classroom in particular. It chills faculty speech. It chills student speech. You want higher education to be an exchange of ideas. You want, we're called the marketplace of ideas. How can we have an exchange of ideas about political differences, for example, if we're afraid to talk because we might be singled out and shot because of that? I remember that in one of the interviews, a faculty member said that she had asked a previous police chief what she was supposed to do in her lecture section of 300 people if a student pulled out a gun. And his response was, and this was about 15 years ago, so that person is not still around, he said, "Duck and cover, little lady." Wow. And that was his response on how you were supposed to protect yourself and your students. And So at the University of Texas at Austin, there are a number of things that faculty members have done to protect themselves and their students. They found out pretty quickly that there were certain places that students could not carry guns, and most of them were off campus. So many of them moved their office hours to churches or to bars, which had previously not allowed guns on the premises. Faculty members who were lucky enough to have an enclosed office could make a statement that they did not allow guns in their office, but that was just a statement and nothing else. A lot of faculty members moved their presence online. They taught more online courses even before the pandemic. They had more individual class meetings that were online. And there are other faculty members who just voted with their feet. They left, and some of them left in a very noisy way, saying campus carry was the reason they left. So there were a number of ways that people responded to the fear and the chilling of speech on campus. Likewise, there were advisors who were very, very concerned about talking with students. One of them said something to the effect that she was talking to a student who had previously been chastised for carrying a gun on campus before campus carry went into effect. And she had several people who were on standby in case that student came in and brandished a gun at her for talking about carrying a gun and his previous conviction. So there were many people, not just faculty members, but many people who were really concerned about the possibilities of gun violence over some very small matter, which may have been blown out of proportion by a particular student or a particular faculty member.
Yeah, I'd just add.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, sorry, man. I was just going to add to that that our colleagues over at the University of Houston, the as they were preparing for the implementation of campus carry, the Faculty Senate there gave a presentation on it and basically discouraged faculty from having conversations in the classroom that might be provocative. They said, you know, that the language in their slide was "don't go there" in quotation marks, meaning, you know, don't risk agitating somebody in your teaching.
But there are so many issues that,
of course,
part of a good education, you have to go there.
Exactly.
That's, you know, any education worthy of its name is going to, you know, obviously with sensitivity and not imposing particular perspectives, but to raise those issues and make them accessible to discussion and testing is part of what any education is about.
Yes, and that was a big part of the basis of the lawsuit that some of our colleagues at UT Austin filed as a response to campus carry, saying that it was going to effectively limit their ability to teach in a manner and to teach the content that they wanted to and that they thought was you know sort of most valuable to students. Of course, that argument didn't prevail with the federal court system. You know, it was they were sort of told that it was hypothetical, right? That unless there was actually a harm that had been illustrated by an incident, that this was all just sort of speculation. So I guess wait till somebody actually gets shot
that upset.
It. Yeah.
So there are a number of different issues that are raised in your book. Things about the the impact of campus carry on community colleges in particular. But one of the important ones, I think, that I'd like to talk about is the impact that campus carry has on suicide rates. And it seems that our culture is just sort of coming to grips or waking up to the real problems of mental health among students. And now we're going to insert into that volatile situation firearms. And I was wondering if either of you wanted to speak to this issue of the relationship between campus carry and suicide among students.
Yes, I can tackle that. There are a number of unintended consequences of campus carry. And one of the most important is the more guns in circulation, the higher the suicide rate. And actually on college campuses, this tends to affect two groups. One is 18 to 24-year-old young men who are at higher risk of suicide. And I've lost some young family members to suicide, and so I'm very in touch with that issue. So the more guns, the higher the suicide rate. And we've seen that since the pandemic, as gun sales have increased what seems like every month, the suicide rate has gone up. Now, certainly the stress of the pandemic had a lot to do with that, but just Absolutely. More guns means more suicides. And so there is a risk.
Guns are the most effective means. And that's
right.
From what I've seen is that, you know, people who attempt suicide by other means have a higher rate of survival than
yes.
people who try it with firearms.
Exactly. And then the second group affected by more firearms would be people who are victims of intimate partner violence. That also increases with more guns in circulation. And that is an issue on college campuses as well as in society in general.
Mm-hmm. If I can add a little bit to that,
sure.
I would say, you know, that the effects of campus carry policy on campus suicide rates are a little bit opaque. It's not as evident as murders would be, right? Because the Clery Act requires universities to report homicide and other crimes to the Department of Education, and so that data is available. But homicides on college campuses have always been exceedingly rare. Suicides are not documented by the Clery Act, but there are some efforts to try to get sort of quantitative data about campus suicides and what effect campus carry may have had. Marjorie Sanfilippo at Eckerd College did a survey of directors of college counseling centers in campus carry states as well as states without campus carry policies, including Texas. The data that she's collected so far have indicated a rising rate of completed suicides at schools that have implemented campus carry. And then also Alan Schwartz, the late Alan Schwartz of University of Rochester, spent most of his career studying college suicide. And he found a pretty clear correlation between amount of time that people spent on college campuses, where at the time guns were not allowed, with the suicide rate. You know, so students who were commuters, for example, had a higher suicide rate than students who lived on campus. There were several different categories where he was measuring this across and finding that basically the more time people spent in this environment that was, you know, where guns were prohibited, the less likely they were to die of suicide, which of course is consistent with decades of research in the social sciences just about suicide and firearms in general.
Sure. So I know this wasn't your chapter, and if you are if it's hard to talk about, that's fine. But the chapter on campus carry and community colleges was fascinating. And Matt, you just mentioned that, you know, here at Oakland, we're primarily a commuter school. But community colleges have these sort of really permeable borders between the campus and the outside community. I was thinking, for instance, you know, the issue of having weapons near children. And our university runs a daycare center that's really well regarded in the community. And so there's the possibility that if Michigan were to institute something like this, that we would have weapons on a in a daycare center. There are a number of issues that get raised in that chapter. I was wondering if you wanted to touch on any of them.
Sure. Community colleges are unique kinds of institutions. Many of them are in rural areas where, in fact, there may be higher gun carry rates, because they may not be necessarily handguns. They may be rifles for people who live in rural areas and go hunting or go out on their farms and need a rifle to take care of the wildlife on their property. Sure. So there are more people who are carrying guns or leaving guns in their car on college campuses. At the same time, there is this huge movement for early college high school where students as young as 13 may be attending classes on college campuses. And with the support of state and federal governments, the early college high school and similar kinds of movements have grown exponentially. They're considered as a means of having access for students, particularly in rural areas where there are not a lot of choices in the high school. So it's important to note that there may be very young students in regular classrooms on many college campuses that have campus carry. The daycare centers and children's centers are exempt from the carry rules, but that doesn't apply in community colleges where there is some kind of early college high school or a dual credit program. So there are very young students who can be exposed to guns at an early age, and it's very difficult to segregate out those younger students from the rest of the population and the classes that they're in. So that's a real dilemma for community colleges.
Sure. I'd also like to ask a little bit about the impact of campus carry on communities of color. The chapter on that was very impressive. I was wondering if you would be able to talk a little bit about those issues.
So that chapter was written by our colleague Richard Reddick from the University of Texas and Anthony Sedial, who is an educational consultant. Almost every, but dozens of departments and centers and programs on the University of Texas campus issued statements formally opposing campus carry as it was sort of making its way into our reality at UT Austin. And maybe the strongest of those came from the Department of African and African Diaspora Studies, which said that, you know, they suffer a greater risk, which is, you know, true in the general population of gun violence, and there's no reason to think that it wouldn't be true as well in the campus context. Of course, part of this goes to those provocative ideas and the context of teaching things like critical race theory, right? That could provoke strong reactions from people, and that
are often the kind of
things that people were concerned about when raising these objections to campus carry in the first place. I think another thing that's really important in that chapter that Dr. Reddick and Dr. Sediel discuss is that, you know, gun rights are enjoyed differently by people of color very often than white people. So, you know, there's an example of an incident at Portland State University where a man named Jason Washington, who had a concealed carry permit and, you know, so was legally authorized to carry a firearm, crossed that permeable border between the public community and the campus. You know, there was a bar right across the street from campus, and there was an argument that kind of rolled out of that bar and across the street onto campus. This man, Jason Washington, was actually trying to break up a fight between other people, and the gun he was carrying fell out of its, fell on the ground in the course of this scuffle. And when the campus police arrived and they saw that gun, they shot and killed him. Yeah. And, you know, we've seen plenty of incidents of police violence disproportionately targeting people of color. And, you know, it seems that the campus police may not be immune from that same outcome.
No reason to think that they would. So your final chapter talks about, is entitled Ways Forward. I was wondering if you wanted to tell us a little bit about responding to campus carry as we are as educators or as scholars.
Yes, it's clear that the response from colleges to campus carry has been really weak. A lot of administrators kind of once campus carry goes through and there's a policy, they kind of don't like to talk about it after that. But it is important that the university community be involved in setting policies and that everyone feels that they are safe on campus. For example, there are many examples of accidental discharges, particularly in residence halls, where
your stories there are just frightening.
Oh yeah, they really are. So colleges and universities need to very carefully look at that issue. If they have campus carry in their state, what will they do with residence halls? Will they allow guns there? Who gets to carry a gun there? Will they have lockers, which are very expensive, or some other means of storage? And that would cut down on a lot of the accidental discharges. There have been a number of instances at the University of Texas at Austin and other schools of people who conceal carry guns, leaving their guns abandoned in a restroom. Without going into all the details, evidently, if you carry a holster, use the facilities, it is very awkward. And there have been people who have, as they were using the facilities, shot themselves accidentally in the lower body.
Yes.
That's all I'll say.
Very good.
Then others who just take the gun off and leave it on a counter. There have been a number of those abandoned weapons at UT, and the police department's not really sure what to do with them. What legally they can action they can take. There are risks. There are a lot of unintended consequences that universities need to consider. It's also very important to have training, and not just for the departments that are large and have resources to hire people to bring in trainers about how to respond during a gun incident, but that needs to be available to everyone. And at the University of Texas at Austin, we do have a number of online trainings that we use. But in addition to that, those trainings are supplemented by, in some departments, some outside trainers coming in. And so there was a split in the beginning, at least, between those departments with resources to better implement the policy and those departments that were poorer, smaller, weaker, and their inability to have special trainings.
Mm-hmm. I would add that one of the pedagogical responses that university faculty can try to implement, and that could be aided by that kind of training that Pat's talking about there, is trauma-aware pedagogy that includes sensitivities to gun violence and the victims of gun violence, right? When we're thinking about the content of our courses and the manner of our material as we present it, yes, people are certainly aware of the possibility that people in their classroom may be proponents of gun rights or may be carrying a gun and may be, provoked. But we also have to be aware of the people who maybe are victims of gun violence, and that if we're going to be talking about guns in a context where there are guns, that we need to be sensitive to their traumas as well. I think also maybe Tom, where you were going with this question had a little bit to do with our advocacy for mm-hmm. research.
Yes.
That universities have the ability to support really necessary research into gun violence and to campus carry specifically, sure, but also to gun violence in general. As I'm sure you know that the federal funding through the Centers for Disease Control was stymied for a long time by congressional threat of defunding their injury prevention unit. Because in the 90s, they had done some research that indicated that, owning guns increased your risk of being shot. They perceived that as being advocacy and anti-gun advocacy. And they said that it basically couldn't do that kind of research or couldn't find results that it's actually more nefarious than just you can't do the research. It was banning research that produced conclusions that said that maybe guns everywhere is not great. That's beginning to change. We've actually just now begun to see the CDC this year start actually funding some gun violence research after decades of stagnancy, but universities have not been under that same restriction, and it's been an area that has been avoided traditionally by academics because it's distasteful. I mean, there was a very famous law article that was authored in maybe 30 years ago about the embarrassing Second Amendment, when the premise of that article was that academics basically just didn't want to talk about guns because it was seen as sort of silly and getting into the political realm, in the same way that maybe people might be a little reluctant to talk about other hot button issues, like abortion. That needs to change because this is an area of where public policy and public health intersect, and where there are 40,000 Americans dying and over 100,000 Americans being injured every year from gun violence. And we're making policies that are not very well informed. And it seems like that, you know, public scholarship has a role to play there. And there are a lot of different disciplines that could contribute to to informing those decisions. You know, it's not just public health. I mean, that's the area where we do see, we have seen in medicine and public health and a little bit in the social sciences, some good research and progress that's been made over decades. But really, you know, there's plenty of room for history to be a relevant part of that dialogue, and for philosophy and for engineering, you know, or even architecture, right? The design of, I mean, this is something that you've written about, the safety of public buildings.
Anybody who considers, you know, I work in an area that considers itself to be critical theory, and I would be hard pressed to point to studies emanating from that domain that discuss the issues of guns. It just doesn't, you know, although, as you said, you put it, you both say in your acknowledgments, and this is sort of where I wanted to wrap up today. You thank the contributors to your work, and really all of the essays in this collection are terrific, and each one is kind of a journey that you're led through as you move through the entire text. But you thank them and say that this is a hard topic to talk about. This is a hard thing to study. This is a hard thing to write about. So I'm wondering, and we just have a few minutes here, what makes you want to continue this work?
That's a very good question. I think I can say that through the interviews that we've done, I've seen the impact on individuals, the real feeling of being demoralized and losing control, because so much is dictated to you under campus carry. You can't say certain things. You have to act in certain ways. There are lots of questions about the policy and how to implement it, and those questions aren't always addressed. So the social psychological impact is really high, and I have not interviewed any students about this, and in part because the campus has been closed down. But the faculty and staff that I have talked with have said again and again how demoralized they are. One faculty member said, "When I go to a conference out of state, I don't tell anyone I'm from Texas. I just say I'm from the Southwest because I'm so embarrassed about campus carry. And I don't want to get into an argument because I don't support campus carry." So it's been really difficult. And so they feel helpless. And many of them have left. There have been scholars who've even refused to come and give lectures on campus because of the campus carry issue. So this whole loss of control is a really important one because of the impact on turnover, for one thing, and also productivity. It's probably, you know, one of the issues that reduces productivity more than any other, particularly every time there is a shooting, no matter where it is. It may not even be on a college campus. And I will say that one of the things that happened after Virginia Tech is that most institutions developed something that they call behavioral concerns programs, where if you're concerned about a student, that you can talk with a counselor, you can make a binding referral to a counselor. I know I've used that process before, and it's not ever been from someone for someone who I was afraid was carrying a gun. It was for someone that I was really concerned about, that I thought they might do some harm to themselves and not to anyone else. So that's a really important step. If universities have not done that, it is necessary.
Yeah, I would say, you know, people often ask me, you know, why I sort of ended up on the gun policy beat as a journalist. And you know, people have wondered before if I had any personal, you know, motivation, if I'd suffered some kind of trauma or something like that. You know, my answer was no. As I've, you know, continued to live with and think about these issues, I realized, you know, there are actually quite a few points of intersection in my life with gun violence, and I think that's just normal in the U.S. that everybody knows someone who has died by suicide with a firearm, or has, you know, been threatened with a firearm, or has been proximate to some sort of tragedy with guns, and you know, I think we've gotten to a point where we sort of just accept it as the normal context. And as I've learned more about it and met survivors of gun violence, and advocates and, researchers, you know, I've been impressed with the notion that, it's not going to get better unless people really actively, address it, and that in fact, as a matter of policy, we've been moving in the wrong direction for decades. You know, the general trends in American policy at the state level, in most states, has been to make all these policies more permissive, and you can see the consequences of that in people's lives. Sure. Yeah. And so that's what motivates me. Yeah.
Okay. Pat Summers and Matt Valentine, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And also thank you for this book. As our campuses return to whatever it is the normal is going to look like after the pandemic, this book should really be at the top of all of our reading lists. Once again, that is Campus Carry, Confronting a Loaded Issue in Higher Education, from Harvard Education Press. This has been Tom DeSena for the Education Channel of the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.